This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Hear that? Believe it or not, summer is just around the corner. Luckily, Armor All, America's most trusted auto appearance brand, has what your car needs to get that perfect summer shine. Plus, now through May 31st, we'll give you $5 for every $20 you spend on Armor All products. That means car wash pods, protectant, tire shine, you name it. Find out how to get your $5 rebate at ArmorAll.com. Armor All, less work, more clean. Terms apply.
Welcome to Intelligence Squared. I'm producer Catherine Hughes. In the past decade, the power of Chinese state surveillance has reached into all aspects of its citizens' lives, from the app which processes most of the country's payments to gait recognition technology which can identify someone simply from the way they walk. On this episode of the podcast, we were joined by Josh Chin, Deputy China Bureau Chief for the Wall Street Journal, to explore China's growing quest for social control and why this should worry us all. Our host for this discussion is Katie Stallard, Senior Editor for China and Global Affairs at The New Statesman. Here's Katie with more.
I'm delighted to introduce our guest today, Josh Chin. Josh is the Deputy China Bureau Chief for The Wall Street Journal. He is an award-winning journalist who spent 6 years as a politics reporter in China, covering law, civil society, and the government's use of technology. On which topic, he is the co-author with Lisa Lin of Surveillance State: Inside China's Quest to Launch a New Era of Social Control, which I cannot recommend highly enough. So with that, let me say, Josh, welcome. It's great to see you. I want to start, as you do in the book, in Xinjiang, where you describe the utterly dehumanizing process through which a Uyghur couple, Tahir Hamut and his wife Marhaba, are taken down into the basement of a police station to have their faces scanned, their fingerprints taken, and even their blood drawn. I think a lot of the time we tend to focus from the outside on the camps in Xinjiang and the terrible atrocities that have been reported there. But could you give us a sense of the role that technology and surveillance are playing in the Chinese Communist Party's efforts there?
Right, yeah. I think to understand Xinjiang, I think you need to step back just a little bit, right, to just sort of understand the background of the conflict there. So for people who don't know, Xinjiang is it's in the remote northwestern corner of China. It's a huge area, about twice the size of Texas. Like Texas, it's resource rich, but it's always been a really difficult place for the Communist Party to control. And that's because it's home to 14 million Turkic Muslims, mostly Uyghurs, who really have almost nothing culturally in common, or very little culturally in common, with the Han Chinese, and many of whom are really resentful of Communist Party rule. And so, you know, for decades and decades, the Communist Party has tried to impose control in Xinjiang without success. You know, starting in the sort of early 2010s, the resistance there was starting to get a little bit, you know, increasingly violent. So in 2016, after years and years of failed crackdowns, the Communist Party decided to basically try a new tack. And what they did was they built this network of internment camps, of a sort of a gulag that people know about and that you mentioned. But what they also did was they married that with this network of 21st century surveillance technologies. And these were, you know, these were cameras. They had, you know, they installed, you know, clusters of AI powered cameras, microphones, digital checkpoints, all sorts of sensors that essentially tracked and categorized Uyghurs, right? So it would collect behavioral data about every Uyghur in Xinjiang, and it would use that data to try to predict whether or not they would be a threat to the Communist Party in the future. And Uyghurs whose behavior suggested they would be a threat, they were categorized as unsafe, and those were the people who were sent to the camps to be re-educated.
So what does that look like at a personal level for a Uyghur couple like Tahir and Marhaba, who you describe? What does that mean in terms of their daily life, dealing with what you describe there as these digital checkpoints and this pretty ubiquitous surveillance?
Right. So yeah, if you were a Uyghur living in Xinjiang, particularly at the time when I was reporting there in sort of late 2017, 2018, into 2019, essentially your life, your entire life was subject to surveillance virtually around the clock. So if you walked outside, if you wanted to go to a market or a bazaar, you wanted to go into a hotel or a bank, any public place, you had to go through a checkpoint that would, where you would scan your ID card and also scan your face. It would match your face to your ID card, and that'd be a digital record of your movement. And if there was anything on your record that flagged you as a high risk person, an alarm would go off and security personnel would swoop in and drag you off to interrogate you. But even, you know, you didn't even have to go into a bank or a market or anything like that. Just walking down the street, you have police that would wave you over and demand that you hand over your smartphone and plug that into a smartphone scanner that would scan your entire phone in a minute or two and discover, you know, basically scan it for any kind of digital contraband, right? So things like encrypted chat apps or even things as benign as pictures of Turkish movie stars that the Communist Party thought were sort of representative of a Turkish nationalist identity. There were, of course, there were cameras on street corners that could identify you by your face and track you that way. And, you know, for certain Uyghurs, including Tahir and Marhaba, the couple that I opened the book with who had traveled overseas and who had sort of international connections and were themselves, you know, fairly influential, those sorts of Uyghurs were subject to this really, really intensive biometric data collection. So, you know, in the case of Tahir and Marhaba, they were called down to the basement of a police station, and they had not just fingerprints, but their blood drawn. They were asked to read a newspaper and have their voices recorded. And then at the very end, they had 3D scans of their faces made so that a facial recognition camera could recognize them from basically any angle.
What did they tell you about their experience of that process? I mean, it sounds like in part, this is about establishing this real sense of control on the part of the authorities.
Right, right. I mean, you know, what was really fascinating actually in talking to them about this is that actually it sort of crept up on them slowly, you know, because this was a population that was used to being subject to control and to a certain level of surveillance. I mean, there have always been cameras in Xinjiang, and they didn't quite realize, you know, sort of bit by bit, the system sort of grew and became more sophisticated. And it wasn't until after they'd had all their biometric data collection that they realized just how completely their lives were being monitored and controlled. And then it just became extremely terrifying and suffocating. And they were sitting in their apartment and they were watching like their neighborhood empty out as more and more Uyghurs were being taken away. You know, first it was like young men and then older men and then women. And, you know, pretty soon their neighborhood was just it was a really busy neighborhood in a really thriving area of Urumqi, the capital of Xinjiang. And within a few months, it was empty. And so, you know, for them, they formulated this plan to escape, and they eventually did escape, although it took a huge effort. But for Uyghurs who couldn't escape, I mean, they still live with this sense of just constantly being watched, and to a large degree, a lot of them at this point have just internalized this idea that everything they do is being measured and monitored.
And you describe what's happening more broadly across China as a radical experiment to reinvent social control through technology. How would you say what we're seeing happening now under Xi is different to the kind of mass surveillance that we've seen under past authoritarian regimes?
Right. Well, first, I think to understand this, we have to, you know, again, step back a little bit. And I think it's important to note that, you know, surveillance in a certain sense is basically indivisible from the concept of a state. The famous anthropologist James C. Scott wrote in his book, Seeing Like a State, he said all states essentially, almost from the beginning of time, have gathered information about the people they rule, right? And he described this as a process of rendering societies legible. And you kind of have to do this if you're a state, right? And you need to, if you want to levy taxes or conscript troops, you need to know who in your society makes, you know, certain amounts of money or has sons who are of a sort of military age, right? So this has always kind of been a part of governing peoples, collecting information about them. And, you know, in the 20th century, you saw this sort of taken to an extreme with totalitarianism, right? You had you know, figures like Hitler and Stalin. They didn't just want to make states legible. They wanted to sort of scientifically engineer them. They wanted to gather enough information that they could actively manipulate states and sort of mold them in ways that they thought in their minds were scientifically desirable. And of course they failed, and they failed in part because they didn't have the technology. They didn't have the tools to do that. And so in China, what you're seeing, you know, with this recent explosion in the capabilities in artificial intelligence capabilities, and also this massive data collection that the internet has enabled, is the Communist Party believes it now has the tools to engineer society, right? In theory, they believe that if they collect enough data and they build the right analytical tools, they can not just solve problems quickly, they can actually solve social problems before they even arise, right? And sort of build a society that runs kind of perfectly, you know, without problems. And that's sort of where they're aiming.
Could you give us a sense of the scale of what we're talking about here in terms of the data collection that you mentioned, and just the, you know, the sheer scale of these surveillance networks that the party has built?
Right. Yeah. It's just massive, right? It's, you know, the Chinese government has access to data on a scale that no other government in history or now, you know, can even begin to match. If you just kind of look at the numbers, it's almost hard to wrap your mind around, but they, you know, China has something on the order of 400 million surveillance cameras. And people in the UK, people often say when you talk about surveillance, like, oh, well, look at London. London has so many cameras. That's true. It does. But a lot of those cameras, they date back to the Troubles, right? They're old cameras. They're from the 80s and 90s. They're kind of decrepit and they're fuzzy and they don't work that well. In China, most of the surveillance cameras are state of the art. So that means they have facial recognition capabilities. It means that they can recognize someone by the way that they walk. They have gait recognition, and they can do crowd analysis, all sorts of analytics. You also have in China, you know, close to a billion smartphones, which the government can use and during the pandemic did use to track where basically everyone in the country was going and had been. And then finally, I mean, just one more thing, which I think is really, really amazing in China, is mobile payment apps, right? Which, you know, let you know, you've spent a lot of time in China, and anyone who's been in China knows this. They're sort of ubiquitous. Basically, nobody uses cash anymore. And these apps, they do 10 times the transaction volume every year as MasterCard globally. And that, of course, is what people spend their money on, is just incredibly, incredibly valuable behavioral data in terms of telling you what people value, what their priorities are. And so the Chinese government has access to essentially all of that information, which is just offers really unparalleled insight into Chinese society.
Does that create a potential mechanism of control too? Because as you say, these mobile payment systems, you're really dependent on your access to these platforms to be able to pay for things. So are people aware that if they are pushed off the platform or they're not allowed to use their account, that has real, you know, live, real world consequences?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that is, you know, there's nothing more devastating if you're a Chinese person, you're in China, than to lose access to WeChat, which is this do everything app made by a company called Tencent. That is, you know, it's essentially Facebook, Instagram, Amazon, PayPal, Twitter, Orbitz, all combined into one. It is almost impossible to do anything in China without this app. You know, you pay your bills using it. You talk to your friends. You book travel. You invest, and you know, that data is incredibly valuable to the government. Obviously, in a way that, you know, really no tech company in the U.S., for example, is valuable. You know, like the, you know, no, it's just incredibly hard to get all that big of a cross section of data in one place. But yeah, as you point out, if you misbehave on that platform, if the government decides that your behavior is not, if they don't like your behavior, they can kick you off, and then you lose access to everything, and life becomes, you know, just incredibly difficult.
The events calendar is filling up here at Intelligence Squared, and to create each one, we obviously rely on some brilliant guests and onstage talent. But behind the scenes, there's also a producer, a production team, and the budget in the mix too. You've got to keep an eye on all of that stuff in one place. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. And you can cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because it's super easy to get started. NetSuite exists in the cloud, you see, no hardware needed, so you're cutting IT costs too. That's why over 37,000 companies have already made the move. And now, by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared. netsuite.com/squared.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYN ads.com.
And you point out early on in the book that much of the underlying technology for these tools comes from places like Silicon Valley, and that many democracies are also now grappling with the relationship between big technology and individual freedoms.
Yeah, I mean, I think that was one of the things I think in researching this book that we were really surprised to find. It was, I mean, obviously we knew that, you know, American tech companies had been involved in China, been coming to China for a long time, and we knew, you know, as you know, tech reporters, we sort of, you know, had this idea of course, you know, companies like Cisco, these old Silicon Valley companies, had been in China early to help it build the Great Firewall, like the system of internet filters and censorship that China uses. But I don't think we realize quite how important, just actually totally vital to the Chinese surveillance state these companies really are. And from the very beginning. And, you know, I mean, just as an example, Intel, right, which makes chips, they very early on spotted what would become one of the more important Chinese surveillance companies that makes video networking equipment, which connects networks of video cameras together. They had a venture capital arm that found this small company that had originally done video surveillance for the 2008 Olympics, and they invested in them, nurtured them, helped turn them into this kind of surveillance behemoth, and then also sold them chips. And then through this company became sort of the chip provider of choice to most of the surveillance companies in China. And so now Intel sells just a huge number of chips to surveillance companies in China, or has up until recently sold huge numbers of chips to Chinese companies. You also have like storage companies like Western Digital. I mean, people who've bought external hard drives for their computers might recognize that, or Seagate. You know, these companies sell the storage drives that are used to collect surveillance footage in places like Xinjiang. So essentially, the surveillance state in China really wouldn't function without American technology companies.
You have a great quote from a senior executive at Hewlett-Packard talking about the supply of some of their technology to a network in Chongqing, where he says, "We take them at their word as to the usage. It's not my job to really understand what they're going to use it for." Do you think that kind of response, that kind of attitude is sustainable, given what we now understand about what this technology is actually being used for?
Right. Yeah. I mean, that's a kind of an age old line for American tech companies, right? I mean, this actually goes all the way back to 1930s Germany and IBM, when IBM was selling sort of essentially the proto computer, these punch card tabulators that eventually evolved into computers to the Nazi regime to help them track Jews. They said the exact same thing. They said, "Oh, well, we just sell the machines. We don't know what they're being used for." I think it's getting really hard now. I think with the level of scrutiny you have around China and what it's doing with these technologies, the U.S. government has been very aggressive in imposing export restrictions on certain technology companies. So major surveillance camera makers like Hikvision, which is the Chinese company, is the largest surveillance video camera maker in the world. There are restrictions around U.S. companies exporting technology to that company and to a lot of other companies. But the trick is there are a lot of loopholes. You know, I mean, global supply chains are so complicated now. It is actually quite hard to track where everything is going. I mean, one example recently was that an American chip company called NVIDIA, which makes graphics processing units, high-end graphics processing units, which are really, really useful in AI and training artificial intelligence algorithms. The U.S. government banned NVIDIA from selling its most advanced chips to certain Chinese companies. But if you check on Taobao, which is like a Chinese version of eBay, you can buy that chip from some random guy. So, you know, it's just so hard to control this sort of thing. I think companies are having to face it now, but they're also finding other ways to sell that equipment.
You write that you don't want to reduce the story of this country of 1.4 billion people down to a narrative of simple oppression. And we've already talked a little bit about the mobile payment systems. But what are some of the other applications of technology that you looked at, perhaps those that we would classify as the more benign applications of this technology?
Right, right. Yeah. You know, I mean, that was one of a really sort of interesting aspect of doing this book, of pursuing this research, because, you know, we started in Xinjiang, which was an unequivocally dystopian place, right? And you know, was straight out of 1984, the novel 1984. But as we looked wider, we found other places where this exact same technologies were being used to sort of make people's lives easier. And, you know, I mean, I think significantly these were wealthy cities. These were Han Chinese cities, places that were already pretty safe and pretty stable, that the Communist Party wasn't terribly worried about. And in those places, the technology was a benefit, right? So in Hangzhou, for example, and Hangzhou is a major tech hub on the east coast of China. It's home to Alibaba, which is one of China's biggest tech companies, does e-commerce, cloud computing. It's also home to Hikvision, the camera maker I mentioned before. The government in Hangzhou several years ago teamed up with Alibaba to build what is called the city brain. And that is essentially moving a bunch of essentially seeding the entire city with lots of sensors, cameras and other sorts of sensors, and centralizing all the data from those sensors and using that data to make the city run more smoothly. And one of the more striking examples of this was in traffic management. They actually have a system where they can track essentially almost every car in the city and use it to optimize traffic. But the other thing they can do is with ambulances. They've installed a system on ambulances that allows them to get to a hospital quicker. So one example we found, there was a woman who lived on the outskirts of Hangzhou, and an older woman, and she was doing laundry in a creek and she had fallen in and nearly drowned. Luckily, a neighbor saw her and pulled her out. But like, they needed to get her to the hospital. They called the ambulance and loaded her up, and the ambulance flipped the switch and it basically essentially turned all of the lights green along the entire pathway to the hospital. And she arrived there in half the time or less than it would have taken her to get there. Anyway, they pumped her stomach and she was fine. Right. So this, you know, it was one of these kind of just amazing examples of how technology, you know, can, you know, be a matter of life and death in a positive way. And in other areas, they've sort of automated the ability to spot litter or to spot misparked cars and that sort of thing. And so basically people who in Hangzhou just kind of live this algorithmically blessed existence, right? Where there's just very, very little friction.
And what did you hear in the course of your reporting from people about their own attitudes to that? Could you sum up, it's a very unfair thing to ever ask people reporting from China, could you just sum up rough impressions from 1.4 billion people? But yeah. what kind of things did you hear from people about their own attitude to this use of technology?
Right. Yeah. You know, I think what we discovered talking to Chinese people is that, you know, perceptions of state surveillance kind of vary widely depending on who you are and where you are, right? So obviously every Uyghur we talked to was terrified, and a lot of them didn't want to talk to us at all for good reason. In Hangzhou, you know, people were they were generally happy with it. You know, I think, you know, most people have this attitude, most people there had this attitude that if you haven't done anything wrong, you don't have anything to worry about, right? And that's not just a Chinese attitude, by the way. I mean, one of my more vivid experiences while I was working on this book was when I was doing some reporting on state surveillance in the United States, and I was at JFK Airport flying back to China and standing in the security line. And there was a couple standing in front of me talking about a media report about state surveillance in China. And the, I remember the wife saying, oh, you know, so it sounds so awful and terrifying. And the husband saying, well, if, you know, that exact line, if you haven't done anything wrong, you don't have anything to worry about. So I used to think that was a Chinese idea. It turns out it's maybe more human. But you know, a lot of people in China, you know, there is this question of how much Chinese people value privacy, which is a really difficult one, I think, to answer. The word for privacy in China didn't appear in the official modern dictionary until 1998. So it is a relatively new concept. But, you know, people do, you know, especially in wealthy cities like Hangzhou or Beijing or Shanghai, I mean, people know they have a concept of privacy, they value it. But a lot of people sort of felt like, at least prior to the pandemic, which we can talk about in a bit, they were pretty happy. They were pretty happy with it. They felt like the sacrifice in privacy was worth the gains made in convenience and security.
You write that China's network of digital sensors is often described as all-seeing, and it certainly goes further than any previous state surveillance network. But in fact, it's still riddled with blind spots. Can you give us a sense of what some of those blind spots are and what you meant by that?
I mean, I think there is, I mean, all seeing is an easy shorthand, but I mean, really, we're still not to that point in technological development where any surveillance system is truly all seeing. And this is true even in Xinjiang. Just the mere fact that we were able to write about Xinjiang and interview Uyghurs at all is kind of testament to the fact that the system is imperfect. It's very good. You know, I mean, I do recall one point when I was driving around in Xinjiang in a rental car with a reporting partner of mine. We were in the middle of nowhere on a dirt road trying to find our way to a highway, and we're pulled over out of the blue by a bunch of police in SWAT gear. And it turns out that they told us they found us because a camera had spotted our license plate and sent them a notice. Despite that, we were still able to find blind spots. We were still able to find places where we could talk to Uyghurs, where, you know, whether it was in an apartment or in a car, in an alleyway, right? It was still possible to kind of get information and exchange information that the Communist Party really didn't want us to find. So, you know, there are those blind spots. China is a vast country, and 1.4 billion people is a lot of people to track. So it is difficult. It's just impossible. But, you know, the way that it works is it doesn't actually have to be all seeing, right? The sort of, and this is true basically of all state surveillance systems or any surveillance system period, is that they're most effective by simply persuading people they might possibly see you. So if, and you know, people in China do know that they have internalized this idea that they are being watched all the time. And so there's a huge amount of propaganda around that. So even though the surveillance state doesn't see into every corner, it is sort of embedded in everyone's mind. And in most cases, that's sort of enough to serve the Communist Party's purposes.
You describe the global war on terror as having seeded the field of digital surveillance, but then the pandemic as being the miracle grow that fed its explosion. You touched on this a little bit earlier. What would you explain about the role that technology and surveillance have played in China's approach to pandemic controls?
Right. Yeah. You know, when the pandemic hit, I mean, it really in some ways was like the perfect test for the surveillance system, right? It was this massive threat to public health, to sort of social stability, to the economy, an existential threat, really, in some ways. And so, you know, initially the Communist Party was sort of seemed to be a little bit caught off guard. And so they did, you know, they locked down Wuhan, but not before a lot of people got out of the city and started, you know, spreading the virus around the country. But they very, very quickly got back up to speed. And one of the more remarkable things they did was, you know, in the matter of months, had built a system using cell phone data where they could essentially track everyone in the country. Anyone who had a smartphone, which is essentially everyone in China, they were able to track their movements and do contact tracing in a centralized way. I mean, if you just kind of think about the scale of something like that, it really is just mind-boggling that any government could pull this off in such a short period of time. And then, you know, the system really evolved really quickly. Beyond that, they introduced a system of health codes, so that, you know, everyone had on their smartphone this app with a QR code that was color-coded depending on your level of risk of exposure to the virus. So if you had a green code, you could go anywhere. You had to, you know, similar to Xinjiang, you know, if you wanted to go into a bank or a mall or something, you had to scan in with your code. If it was green, you were fine. If it was yellow or red, you had a problem. And if it was red, you had to quarantine at home. And so, you know, through this system, you know, the first year of the pandemic, China was remarkably successful at controlling the virus, right? I mean, it was, people debate the numbers in China, but, you know, just looking at hospitals and death numbers and just anecdotally talking to people in China, the virus was, for the first year of the pandemic in China, was essentially controlled. And a lot of that was thanks to these technological systems. So, you know, while, you know, you had just bodies piling up in places like New York and London and India, basically everywhere around the world, China was fine. And it was quite remarkable. And actually, in fact, you know, some of the people we talked to in China earlier who were very privacy conscious and who did sort of initially object to being surveilled all the time, after a year of the pandemic, seeing what was happening in the rest of the world, a lot of those people told us, oh, actually, we're fine with it now. You know, it's good. It's keeping us safe.
How did you see those attitudes shift over time, particularly over the last year, as we've seen these really extensive lockdowns in place?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's been one of the most interesting shifts in recent last couple of years, is everything changed in China with the arrival of Omicron, because Omicron as a variant moved faster than surveillance technology was capable of keeping up with. And so the Communist Party had to move from tracking people who might have the virus to using the surveillance technology to keep people locked inside. And so you had, I mean, the most vivid example of this early on was in Shanghai, you know, which is the financial center of China, one of the wealthiest cities in China. And they had an Omicron outbreak there. They tried to sort of manage it in some more nuanced ways than they usually do, and it got out of control. And so then they just locked the city down. And, you know, you had people, you know, 20, 30 million people locked in their apartments, and they were using, you had robot dogs, you know, prowling residential zones, and you had drones flying around to try to track, to see, to make sure that people were not trying to sneak out. And it just became, the city became this one, this kind of gigantic digital prison. And people felt really desperate because the government had not really been prepared for this. So people couldn't get food. A lot of them couldn't get medicine. There was a real sense of panic. But you can imagine in most places in American city, there's just no way you would actually be able to keep all of those people in their apartments, especially if they're starving. But in China, because they had these systems, they were able to keep those people locked up. And it was a real shift. I think, especially if you think about people like, you know, residents of Shanghai, these are people who don't generally feel the sharp end of communist power, right? They generally get all of the benefits. And through this experience, they suddenly had this very, very visceral insight into what it is like to be on the wrong end of Communist Party power, like the Uyghurs have been. And I think that really changed attitudes a lot in China, to the point where you get to November last year, there was a fire in Urumqi, actually, in the capital of Xinjiang, where several people died, and locals believed they died in part because of lockdown measures, because they couldn't get out. And that set off protests across the country. And these were Chinese people who 5 years ago maybe didn't think about the Uyghurs, didn't care about what's happening in Xinjiang. And all of a sudden they're protesting on behalf of Uyghurs. And a lot of them, when we talked to them, it was because they said, no, now we understand, we identify, we get it. And they were so frustrated with the levels of control they'd been subject to that they went into the streets, which in China is an incredibly rare sight. I mean, you almost never see it these days. It was quite a remarkable show of defiance.
Well, unfortunately, we are out of time, so let me encourage you to read Josh and Lisa's terrific book for more. For now, I'd like to thank Josh for a fascinating conversation. The book, again, is Surveillance State, available now from your local bookshop. I'm Katie Stallard, and you've been listening to Intelligence Squared.
Thanks for listening to Intelligence Squared. This episode was produced by Connor Boyle, with editing from Catherine Hughes. We'd love to hear your feedback and what you think we should talk about next, who we should have on, and what our future debates should be. Send us an email or a voice note with your thoughts to podcasts@intelligencesquared.com. And if you'd like to hear more, attend some of our live events, or peruse over 20 years from our back catalogue featuring some of the world's greatest minds, then head over to intelligencesquared.com.